The most destructive wildfires in the history of California are continuing. In Southern California, fires have consumed over 567,000 acres. That's nearly the size of Rhode Island. At least 16 people are dead and more than 1,600 homes have been destroyed. The fires are also taking a toll on fire crews. 11,000 firefighters, many of them working long hours without a break, have been battling the blazes since late last week. At least 10 major fires stretch now from Mount Shasta in Northern California down to the Mexican border. Governor Gray Davis has estimated the cost of the fire thus far at $2 billion. We're going to spend the rest of this program talking about the unique challenges these firefighters are facing in California and about how scientists miles away are helping them. We also want to hear from you, especially if you've ever fought a fire like this or if you're living through the fires this week. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Western Editor for NPR, Bibi Krause. Good of you to come in, Bibi.
Hi, Neil.
And from Boulder, Colorado, Richard Wagoner. He's Program Director at the Wildland Fire Research Collaboratory. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Bibi, let's start with you. Every fire represents a different challenge for those who have to fight it. What about this one?
Well, this one has a lot of the same kind of components that wildland fires have in the sense that they are dealing with some very steep terrain, really dry conditions in Southern California right now. Of course, they're dealing with Santa Ana winds, which are very strong, hot, dry winds that just fan these flames like crazy. But one of the real differences here is they're dealing with lots of homes and development. Generally, you think of wildfires as being out in the middle of the forest,
sure,
you know, in wildlands. There are a lot of homes here, and that really changes how they kind of go about fighting this fire. Generally, when you fight a fire, what you're trying to do first is kind of contain it, and that means just keep it from spreading. And you don't go out there with fire hoses like you do in an urban fire. You go out with shovels and pickaxes and bulldozers, and you try to basically take all the vegetation away from a perimeter around the fire so that it can't get out any farther.
It then starves.
You starve it, exactly. And it's a matter of figuring out, well, where do we put the perimeter so that we're beating the fire before it actually gets to us? Now, that gets a lot more complicated when you've got a lot of houses in there. In a big forest, you just kind of let more of the forest burn. Here, you're really trying to minimize that damage to houses. And so it's very labor intensive. You need a lot more guys. You need a lot, you have to decide, well, where's the perimeter?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to burn, what's not going to burn? And that gets real, real tricky.
Well, you say you need a lot of guys,
And women,
women, of course, and we're using it
generically.
Bi-generically. We hear of a shortage of firefighters. What's that about?
Right. This is not the typical fire season. Now, this is a really hot, dry time in Southern California, but the main fire season is the middle of summer. And generally, fire crews they're seasonal workers for the most part. A lot of them are college kids who, this is their summer work. They come in. You got the big part of that is in the July, August. And by September, it starts to thin out. So, for example, I talked to one agency, and they said in the middle of summer, you'll have 90 to 100 of these hotshot crews. These are sort of the fire SWAT teams that go in. Now, they typically will have about 30. So they really had to somehow just really try to call people in, they just didn't have the people at their disposal they normally would have.
Well, Mr. Wagoner, we've been talking about, the people fighting the fires. You and your team from Colorado helped to gather information to help those firefighters know where to deploy, what assets they do have. What is it that you do?
That's right, Neil. Our job is to really look down the road for the next 5 years and try to bring together the various research groups that are working in fire science and fire technology and come up with ways to integrate this technology so that it is highly relevant to fire managers and firefighters like those that are fighting the Southern California fires. The collaboratory itself is made up of a consortium of national laboratories, universities, members of the federal land management structure, and we just returned, for example, from Melbourne, Australia, coordinating with the new Bushfire Cooperative Research Center down there.
Now, what kind of technology are you talking about?
Well, it covers a wide range. What we're really trying to do is focus on decision support systems. It's pretty easy for researchers to wave their arms and say they've got the best technology to do this, that, or the other. What we're trying to do is work directly with the operational folks who have to make key decisions in short periods of time, try to understand exactly which pieces of information they need, and then, in a sense, work backwards until we figure out which science elements we really need to crack the code on and what technology needs to be developed to deliver that information to them.
Okay, let's get a caller in. Rick joins us on the line from Ramona, California.
Yes, well, I actually experienced a fire firsthand. The flames got within like three-quarters of a mile of my house, and I was getting very nervous.
I can understand that.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, the thing that really helped us out were the air tankers and stuff that came in, and they made about two runs over the line of fire that was coming towards our house, and in two runs, it just completely wiped it out. Now, obviously, they do not fly at night, and they do not fly when it's really smoky. And my question is, why can't they go to high technology with GPS and map of the land radar and also use unmanned aerial vehicle like the Predator or the Global Hawk to fly over and dump water on it? Fortunately, the California Department of Forestry's air tanker base is right there at Ramona, so they had to fly about 5 minutes and they could dump their loads.
Well,
I'm just wondering.
Rick, I can tell you at least part of an answer on the UAVs. They don't carry very much payload. I don't think they'd be an awful lot of help in terms of dumping water. But Richard Wagoner, what about his other question?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Let me take a shot at it. First of all, on the UAVs, what they could do is provide real-time imagery to monitor the fire line. That's very difficult to do today. The problem with UAVs, you know, good technology has to meet several standards. It has to be scientifically sound, reliable, cost-effective, and then usable in an operational sense. The UAVs right now are still not very cost-effective, but that's a technology that's definitely coming along.
Okay, what about the GPS and radar?
That's an excellent question, too. And in the research community, let me just say, first of all, I don't work the operational side these days, but it's my understanding that the reason that we don't fight fires at night is primarily crew safety. Crew safety is number one.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody knows, firefighters on the operational side, we on the research side, know that the fire tends to lay down at night. Well, if it lays down tonight, why not fight it? And picking up on the caller's theme, if the military owns the night, why can't we own the night with regard to fighting fires? The technology is emerging that would probably allow to do that. It would take a lot of work and a lot of focus to bring it about.
Rick, continued good luck with your house.
Yeah, well, I have one more comment.
Well, just hang on just a second, Rick, because I have to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go ahead, one more comment, Rick.
Well, I actually know the man that saw the fire and reported it originally. It was started about a mile from his house, and it was just a little fire that had started. Now, my thing with predators is if they could say, oh, it's there, they could take one load or two planes out there and get it when it's just started, when it's, you know, like 100 feet or 100 square feet or 200 square feet. Obviously, you can't use the predators when it's a raging conflagration like it turned into. But that's the time to kill a fire is when it just starts because it's at its most vulnerable. And another question is, why can't you at nighttime fly over it? We got cluster bombs that we dump munitions on enemy troops and stuff. Why can't we just fly over, drop a cluster bomb, heat-seeking? I think it's 2,000 degrees, so the bomb will go right to it, blow itself up and drop all these water-filled cluster bombs over it from 20,000 feet above the cloud bank.
Okay, Rick, thanks very much. Interesting questions. Let's go now to Walt, and Walt's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hey, Neil, thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting conversation because I grew up in Southern California in Santa Barbara back in 1964 and also in 77. My folks had to evacuate their home. And I've been a firefighter 17 years, smoke jumper throughout the western United States. So I've got some firsthand knowledge with this and talked to some of my buddies already who are out there fighting these fires.
And what's the biggest difficulty they're talking about?
Well, it's the same old story. When a fire starts in the mixed situation like this with structures and wildlands, first-in units have to take care of life and property first. And when they do that, then the fire goes over the hill. And then you're compounded with narrow roads, people coming out while fire resources are trying to go in, and it's just a big mess. It's chaotic. And what really needs to be done is when this all, when the dust settles here, the authorities need to move in with these developers when they go back to rebuild and instigate or institute mandatory building requirements such that you don't have cedar shake rooftops. You mm-hmm. have non-combustible type siding on your house. And
let's get
build neighborhoods that are non-combustible.
Let's get a quick response from B.B. Krause.
Well, I mean, I think he's hitting on a real important issue, and it's one of the real tough things out there. These areas are, by nature, this vegetation is supposed to burn. Some of it, the seeds won't generate on some of these plants unless it burns. So fires are going to happen. And I think he's making a really important point, is that you have to figure out, one, places you don't build at all, but also if you're going to do it, you put what they're calling defensible space around your house. You use materials, as he says, no shake roofs and those sorts of things. There have been some local ordinances, I think, that have tried to get at that, but who knows?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. B.B. Krause, thanks very much. B.B. Krause is NPR's Western editor. She was with us here in Studio 3A. Richard Wagoner, we appreciate your time today as well.
Thanks for having me.
Richard Wagoner is program director at the Wildland Fire Research Collaboratory in Washington. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.